Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 30, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. A Washington, D.C. school is being investigated for pressuring teachers to pass failing students, but is the problem more widespread than we realize? A new study ranks states when it comes to teaching financial literacy, and one school says they're no longer going to use the term freshman. We'll tell you why. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics in news in the world of education, plus we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, it's a dangerous digital world out there, so we have an expert that will help you find resources to teach your students about their own digital footprint. Hey everybody, Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined with data wizard Tyler Cummings of School Status and teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt. Lissa, how you doing?
I'm great.
Tyler, how's it going over there?
Fantastic.
It is almost Christmas time. Tyler, any big plans for the holidays?
I've got a family of two kids, both of them under 10. So yes, we've got some big plans. Going to grandma's, going to Chick-fil-A to visit Santa tonight, going to...
Do all Chick-fil-A's have a Santa? Did I not know about this?
I don't know if all of them do, but my local one does. And, you know, it's... they do a great job. So it's... there'll be pictures with Santa. Santa cow walks around. So that's good stuff.
That darn and Chick-fil-A. Did you hear they opened up their restaurant at the Atlanta airport on Sunday?
Which is typically when they lost closed. All the power?
Yeah, when they lost the power, but they like sprung into action and started working on a Sunday, which they, you know, normally don't do.
Yeah. So that's, you know, hey, it's good chicken.
Lissa, what about you? You got the Christmas shopping done yet?
Oh, goodness. Amazon has helped me a lot. I am just not a shopper. So I've did the thing last night, actually, where it's like, if you don't order today, you're not going to get it in time. You know, right. So I was definitely scrambling last night. So no, I'm not ready. My art business, this is the busiest time of year. And so I will be working on Christmas Eve for sure.
I kind of feel guilty about this, but I would say I'm at like 70% of my Christmas shopping is through the internet now. Where are you guys on that percentage wise in your mind?
Oh, easily. Like probably 95%.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a blessing and a curse because, you know, when your wife shares your Amazon account, she knows what you're going to get her and vice versa.
Oh, no.
So
yeah,
now we have to do things like, hey, neighbor, can I borrow your Amazon account
so that's funny.
What we've done.
I don't feel bad about, and I'm kind of going down a little rabbit hole here, but I don't feel so bad about not going to, say, like the Best Buys or the Walmarts to buy my stuff. But I do feel bad if I'm buying something on Amazon that I could have gotten at a mom and pop place. So I still try to like hit the small stores when possible. But, you know, if it's between Amazon and Walmart and Best Buy, I mean, they're all the same. Massive.
I started doing Amazon shopping, gosh, probably 6 or 7 years ago to help me budget. Like I could put things in the cart, you know, as a teacher, limited budget. So I would kind of keep track of what I was spending and buy little bits at a time. But I went ahead and made my cart early. And I know a lot of teacher friends that do the same just to try to help, you know, keep track and not spend too much. I do buy teacher gifts usually locally.
All right. Well, Lissa, why don't you hop us into the teacher's lounge?
Okay. Well, this is a, some would say, shocking story if they're on the outside of education. Out of Washington, D.C., Ballou High School is under investigation for 6 months now following a 100% graduation rate for the 2017 class. And they are on track for a 100% graduation rate for this 2018 class. This is a school district that has struggled with low graduation volume over the years and been under a lot of pressure. And so...
So it's kind of like when Saddam Hussein won the election with like 99% in his favor, and you're kind of like, is that right?
And so the deal is that, of course, a lot of, you know, I'm sure a lot of people's immediate reaction was like, wow, good for them. They've really turned it around. But what's happened is people from the inside, teachers, have kind of spoken out, and you know, there's investigation being done. And the teachers have been very honest of, no, these children shouldn't have graduated, but we were put under a lot of pressure to pass them. Or, you know, we've touched on this in our podcast before with credit recovery.
Right.
That is a huge factor in this case. Absenteeism, where they're kind of cooking the books a little bit, saying, oh, no, they weren't really absent as much as it appears on paper. Pressure, which we've also touched on in this podcast before, of administrators pressuring teachers to change a child's grade from an F to a D. So, I mean, there's so much about this story. Like, when I read it, I got a little sick to my stomach.
Right.
Not because I think, oh, I can't believe that school's doing it. It's because I know that if it's happened in my career that I've been pressured, which, Tyler, I know you were with us that day we spoke about it. I know it's happening everywhere. So there's this huge outpouring of teachers across the nation saying, oh, yeah, look at our school. Oh, yeah, what about over here? Okay, for example, the credit recovery. You're not really supposed to have a credit recovery course or be allowed to enroll in one unless you have already failed the current course.
Right.
But what's happening at this school and many schools is that these children
are basically behind, or...
Well, let's say they're in trigonometry and they're failing trigonometry. Well, then they immediately enroll them in an after-school credit recovery course of trigonometry while they're in trigonometry before they've ever even
failed
the course.
Tyler, what do you think? Just so our listeners know, like, you were in the classroom teaching as little as, what was that, 2 years ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
2 years ago, and you taught for a long time, too, as well.
13 plus years.
Yeah. And now you're in the classroom almost daily, but you're in different school districts bouncing around.
Teaching teachers now.
So how much of this do you think is happening? Do you ever hear people talking about this?
I do. You know, it's happening everywhere, and that's a shame. In Trezvant High School in Memphis right now is undergoing what looks like maybe criminal charges for changing grades. The high school football coach for the last couple of years has been changing his players' grades so that they'll graduate and be able to go on and play in D1 schools and things like that. They've got some pretty famous kids that come out of that school to go off and play football. But this, I'm looking at an article out of the Commercial Appeal right now. It's more than 1,000 grades have been changed. At least 53 students graduated without earning diplomas. It's not just one school. Oh, look, that's an outlier. This is a pandemic problem.
Yeah. And with Ballou High School, 164 graduating seniors. That's not an overly large class compared to some districts around the nation, you know?
No.
So when you look at that number, 55 of them missed 30 days. 53 missed 60 days. 23 missed 90 days and still graduated.
Wow.
9 missed 120 days and still graduated. And 1 student missed 150 days.
The school year is only like 180 days. So if they missed over 100.
Right. So the administrator, of course, says, oh, well, you know, that may look that way, but really they were here for some of that day. But there's pressure on the teachers to, if a child, this is what the article says, is a student, they interviewed a student, and a student said, you know, I just didn't really have time to go to school because, you know, I'm working and trying to help pay my parents' rent. You know, we deal with different things that other people don't deal with. And so I really would basically go to school every 14 days because that would keep the truancy officer off our back.
Right.
So, and then the student would immediately walk in on day 14 and ask the teacher, do you have a makeup packet? Can I do a PowerPoint? Can I? And so basically the administrator would say, if the teacher said no, then they would get a visit from the administrator to say, what have you done to help meet this child's needs?
Tell me if I'm wrong about this. I want you guys to push back. But I also have to put a little blame on just politicians in general, because over the past 10, maybe even 15 years, we watched politicians talk about education, and they wanted more metrics. They wanted more ways to see how schools are doing, which I get. But it looks like now we're just trying to meet those benchmarks set by people who aren't really in education, and that's how we ended up here. Am I wrong about that, or?
I don't think you're wrong about that at all. I think that's exactly what the problem is, because, you know, when you get a lot of policymakers that have no idea what happens in a school telling schools what they need to do, and then that just, it's a downward spiral from there. So they create, they treat schools like a business. They say, you've got to do this and you've got to meet this and think about customer satisfaction. No, it's not customer satisfaction. It's teaching a student. It's teaching a child.
I'll wrap it up with this on this topic, and then we'll switch to what Tyler has. If you're listening to this and you've watched or witnessed, you know, or been pressured to cut corners to meet certain benchmarks, like we're talking about at this particular high school, email us, private message us on Twitter. It'll be completely anonymous. I just want to know, like, is this really happening all over the country? Just to kind of get a pulse. And we may tell your story, but we, of course, wouldn't use any names or what school you go to or whatever. You can email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. Tyler, what do you know?
Well, financial literacy is something that I want to talk about today because it's something that we're not teaching. There's just no financial literacy that is going on in schools in most states. There's a few states that are doing this pretty well, but the majority of the United States are not teaching students how to do basic things like balance a checkbook, or, you know, maybe we're not writing checks as much anymore, and so people think, oh, you don't need to balance a checkbook, but you're
just
like
how not to go get in debt with a credit card, or
exactly how, what a credit card does, what it means to have a savings account, what it means to have just an emergency fund, you know, very basic things. And we're not teaching it. Most schools, most states have a grade of a B, C, D, or F. There's only, let's see, Alabama, Missouri, Tennessee, Utah, and Virginia are the only states in the United States that have are graded by Champlain College, by the way, with an A grade. That means that they're teaching some sort, there's a requirement before graduation to have some sort of full year finance instruction, basic financial instruction, basic financial tools.
And I will say, this must have changed. I went to school in Virginia and I didn't know anything about financial literacy after I left school there. And I went to school in one of the better counties in the state. So,
yeah. Well, and I went to school in New Jersey, which gets a grade of a B, but I didn't learn anything in high school as far as I know.
I mean, I remember going to my first job and them handing me, what's it, a W-4 that you fill out, you know? And I was like, what does this mean? What is this? How does this impact my life? How important is it that I fill this out correctly? You know, like I was just, I was clueless.
Well, I took that to my dad and said, what do I do? And he, you know, walked me through those things. And my dad was very smart financially and you know, took care of us and ran his own company. So he knew his stuff. But it took, you know, sitting down with him before I ever learned how to do any of this stuff, how to basic things like balancing a checkbook. That's stuff that my dad taught me, which is fantastic. And I'm very proud that he was able to do that for me. But if we're not teaching students how to do this, then there's a lot of dads out there that aren't going to be able to teach their kids because they don't know either.
What states were at the bottom of the list for teaching financial literacy?
Well, not the ones that you would normally think. So, you know, there's always the bottom 50%, right, or the bottom 10% or whatever in education. But this time, Alaska, in California, Massachusetts, they're among the states that get an F.
Wow.
Other states too. So it's Alaska, California, Connecticut, Delaware, Washington, D.C., Hawaii, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Dakota, Wisconsin. They all received an F in this report.
Wow.
And that means that they have no requirement at all for any kind of personal finance education in high school.
If you want to hear an interesting interview, back in episode 24, I believe it was, we interviewed a teacher up in the New England area. I was up in Maine. And she actually believed in a personal finance class. And she kind of had an elective and she transitioned it into this big course. And it's now a requirement for all students at their school. And in fact, they're talking to state legislators trying to make a requirement statewide. So it can be done.
Yeah. And Maine is getting a B on this because they do have some minor financial education requirements. And so that's a good thing. But gosh, you know, if there's basic things that people just need to know how to do. And there's a debt crisis that has occurred and probably will occur again. And, you know, maybe those things could be avoided. I don't think anybody really understands how things like the stock markets work. people, you know, pretend that they know how, but that's because they watched The Wolf of Wall Street once. I guess that's about bonds, really.
But I haven't watched that yet, but I heard don't watch it with your parents.
Don't watch that. No, children. I think that's set a record for dropping curse words in a movie.
I do think that at the collegiate level, there should be a course also. Like, let's say that, you know, somebody's majoring in education. I think that there at the collegiate level should be a course that deals with what your basic income is most likely going to be, and let's set up a budget around that. Let's set up a real world situation around that, and what you what you don't want to do as far as getting all these credit accounts to furnish your apartment or whatever, and the benefits of having a roommate starting out as a young teacher, or you know, that kind of thing, setting up savings, deferred compensation, all those things that they come and meet in your schools.
Right.
You don't know what they're talking about. I didn't. Yeah. When they came in, I honestly thought, okay, all these people are crooks. They're just here to, you know, take my money. But then I realized later, no, actually, those are helpful things, but I just didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, especially health care and what that's going to cost and mean. And, you know,
do you need the supplemental plan?
Yes. I think no matter what your major is in college, I think it's going to all of a sudden become a lot more meaningful at that time when you're in that major to have a course that's specific to your major as far as finances.
It's called the course life, maybe.
The game of life.
Yeah. You know who does do that is college football players. They're required by the NCAA to learn how to manage their finances, especially for those kids that go off to play in the NFL or, you know, the NBA and things like that, because suddenly they get these windfalls of, you know, hundreds of thousands, almost millions of dollars. And so they have these requirements to learn how to deal with that. I don't know if it's an NCAA requirement or if it's a school-wide requirement, but I've seen it in a number of different schools. And those kids learn how to manage their money, and they have to go through these courses before. I'm pretty sure the NFL requires it. So, but that's a great idea.
There's a certain irony that they don't pay them, but they teach them how to manage money. But
yeah.
That's another podcast.
There's a whole documentary on that where they were taken advantage of. All these players were like, I had all this money, and then now it's gone.
Right.
One of my favorite classes that I ever taught, though, was when we would do Walden with Thoreau. And at some point in there, he lists out his finances. He lays out his budget. And the kids kind of laugh because the budget's like, I don't remember exactly, but he's got like $20 to live on for the month. And he explains how he's going to spend this much on nails and that much on like seeds and things like that. And so then I use that as a vehicle to say, okay, guys, how much money do you need to live comfortably? And then we look at that, okay, because they always come out with like $100 million. No, okay, $100,000. All right. Are you going to get $100,000 right out of college? Oh, yeah, I'm going to be rich.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, let's find those jobs that do that. And then we go through those things and we build a budget, and they get very depressed. So.
Right. Yes, that's good. No, that's good. I mean, I know it may be tough on them, but they need a little tough love. Okay, I've got a story for you guys, and I want you to tell me if this is ridiculous or not. I have my own opinion, but this one actually came out yesterday. A school up in New England is eliminating the term freshman to be more gender inclusive, because it's freshmen.
Oh my gosh! So what's it going to be now?
So
fresh people.
that might be better than what they came up with. It's first year students. The school superintendent said that students don't have to call them first year students. They can still use the word freshman. There's no change. Yeah. But the school, which is East Hampton High School, was recently instructed to undergo diversity and inclusion training after being investigated by the AG's office from the state. So they created this committee, and the committee came back with this recommendation, and the school's moving forward with it. And so no more freshmen. Is this ridiculous? Are we getting too soft?
I don't know. You know, I'm all for being politically correct, but there's somebody said this, and I thought this was great. There's a difference between being politically correct and politically stupid. So it's just a word. Like, that's not. It's,
well, and when they go to college, they're going to be called freshmen.
I don't know. Like, I mean, are you insulted as a woman?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that's so stupid. I remember my freshman year, I was the little freshman cheerleader, and I was so excited for my very first pep rally. And we run out there to do our cheer because the varsity squad's already done theirs. And you know what? Each section had their own little thing that they did. The seniors all somehow had newspapers, and they opened them all up. So their whole section was just newspapers that we were looking at. The juniors stood up and turned around, and the sophomores all put pacifiers in their mouth and held up a sign that said fresh meat. So, you know what? That's part of it. Like, you know, like, I don't care. I'm not scarred. I wasn't like, oh, yeah,
why
no.
don't we just call them froshies?
I mean, that is so silly.
So, I guess if you're on the freshman cheerleading squad, you're now the first-year students cheerleading squad?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, what
that
are you?
Sounds
the first-year student football team, first-year right. student basketball
there's,
team.
There's a freshman football team, and then there's a JV football team. So, you know, honestly, I'll tell you what's offensive. I mean, you can edit this out, but when these these little league teams, these little league football teams, they call there's one league called the Midgets. That's what they're called, midget football.
Yeah.
That's what I mean, that's offensive.
I think we used to call them ankle biters, which
fine.
You know, it's a little weird, but yeah, I guess that's not insulting anybody.
I think whoever the committee is, when they came forth with this, sure, the high school went forward with it, but I bet the people that felt like they weren't being treated fairly or equally rolled their eyes too and said, really? That's what you thought we wanted? That's what you thought? Yeah. You know, how about no? How about we wanted a chance to, you know, lead the student council, but the voting is so one-sided that there's never a female president. How about, you know, they probably thought about a little more serious stuff than the word freshman.
Yeah.
Sorry, I guess I'm opinionated.
No, I guess that's probably why the local news picked up the story. It just kind of seemed a little bizarre, I guess. But anyhow, are you guys ready for the bright idea?
Definitely.
We are talking to somebody with commonsense.org, and we're talking about how to teach kids about their digital footprint. You know what I mean when I say that?
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, so just kind of, you know, how to make sure they don't post.
Monitor their presence online.
Exactly. Don't overshare. Don't.
Boy, does that need to be taught like in fourth and fifth grade? Because it's
right along with financial
late.
Education.
That's a good question. I actually, on my list of questions for our guest is, when do you start having
early
this conversation?
These children in middle school, they change so much and they're so egocentric at that time, and they don't mean to be. It just is what it is. And they make some really bad choices online.
So let's see what we've got. Our guest in today's Bright Ideas segment is here to talk to us about teaching students about their digital footprint. Kelly Mendoza is the Senior Director of Learning and Engagement at Common Sense Education. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you much for your time. When we talk about digital footprint, I want to make sure all our listeners are on the same page. What specifically are we talking about there?
So when we talk about digital footprint, we are talking about all of the trail of information that you leave about yourself as you participate online and in digital spaces. So when you share a photo or a comment, when you post anything online, even sometimes what you're actually clicking on and doing is leaving a trail of information about you. And, you know, even if you have it under private settings, like a private account, it can still be shared broadly beyond that.
When you and I were corresponding about this topic, you mentioned to me that you feel like there's a lot of teachers, and you hear from a lot of teachers, they don't really know like how to inform their students about this.
Yeah, I think for us, you know, this is a one of the skills that is really important and that we find schools are struggling with underneath the umbrella of digital citizenship, which is really how to think critically, behave safely, and participate responsibly in the digital world. And so, you know, schools are experiencing issues with students sharing things that are either inappropriate, that they weren't supposed to share, that were private. And, you know, and I not want to pick on teachers, but they're having this issue with teachers as well. So it kind of goes across the board. But I think with students, you know, they're developing and they're learning how to behave online. And in doing so, they're learning sort of the norms around that. And that pretty much any participation or whatever you post online has the potential to go beyond where you intended it to go.
So at what age should teachers, educators be starting to address their students or at least making them aware of the pitfalls of their digital footprint?
So we recommend you can start early, even if kids aren't there yet. What we hear is, well, you know, our kids aren't posting anything online. Our kindergartners aren't even, you know, they're not on social media yet. And you know, maybe at later elementary or middle school, they might be. But you can still teach these concepts early. And so we always recommend start early with digital citizenship, even if you think kids aren't quite there yet. I mean, obviously there's developmental issues, but there are ways that you can help young kids understand that what they do online leaves a trail of information. And there are certain kinds of information that's okay to share and okay, information that's not okay to share, especially for younger kids. We're trying to protect their privacy. So we do have a full K-12 curriculum on digital citizenship. And one of our 8 topics that we address under this skill set is digital footprints and reputations. But an example of K-2, where we can teach, you can teach about digital footprint in K-2, is a lesson that we have called Follow the Digital Trail. And this is a lesson about helping kids understand that everything you do online leaves a trail, just like animal footprints leave a trail, you know, in the mud or in the sand. And so they look at 2 different characters, Mizzle the mouse and Electra the elephant, and they look at these different footprints that the animals are leaving as they post something online, maybe, you know, about their family or about their favorite food or their pet, and that there are differences in what's okay and not okay to post online about yourself. So an example would be, you know, Mizzle the mouse posts that she lives in a mouse hole. Mm-hmm. And Electra the elephant posts her full address that she lives on 123 Peanut Lane in, you know, Elephantville, wherever. So the idea is that you can still share about yourself, but, you know, you don't want to share personal information. You don't want to share, especially younger kids, your address, their real name, their address. I mean, you know, you could even go as far as some kids are sharing, like they just don't know credit card information from their parents and all sorts of issues. And so even though kids aren't necessarily, may not be on social networking sites, they get the concept through this animal leaving tracks in the sand metaphor.
That really is brilliant. And sorry for interrupting you, but how did you guys even come up with, you know, first you must have developers or somebody helping you build these games. And then you guys came up with the idea of using animals. Like, how's that process work for your organization?
Yeah. So we, just a little bit higher level about the curriculum, it is research-based, the digital citizenship curriculum that we offer. And we worked with Harvard Graduate School of Education, who they research digital media and youth, and they research what are the issues that kids are facing online, what are the fault lines that they're falling into. And one of the areas that they saw kids falling into was this digital footprint and reputation type issue, among many other other sort of fault lines. We find that in elementary, especially, you have to make things black and white, kids don't quite have the critical thinking skills that they develop in middle and high school, where then in those grades, you can have them more grappling with scenarios and sort of making decisions about, well, it's a little more gray than the black and white. And then, of course, we know that kids love animals and characters and so forth. So,
One of the things that I saw when I was kind of roaming around in your website that I really liked, because I remember being in elementary school and reading the posters on the wall. Like, I would just kind of be, you know, gazing around the room and I would actually read those. But you guys actually develop posters. And for example, one's the top 10 things to think about before you post. Another I saw was, I took a photo of my friend that I want to share. Now what? And it kind of is this grid of kind of breaking down whether or not you should share that picture. Is all this stuff just free for teachers to go and print on their own? Like, you don't need to sign up or anything? How's that work?
Yes, it's totally free and available to schools. For some of the materials, you do need to register with us as a member. And that just means, you know, registering and basically signing in to access and download the resource.
And they find that by going to commonsense.org. Is that the best starting point? Or
yeah, so you're going to go to commonsense.org/education, or when you go to commonsense.org, you will see education, and you click into the education section, and there you'll see all of our free resources for schools and teachers. And if you click into the digital citizenship section on the left, you will see all of the resources. The posters I really love, and I actually have seen these in my daughter's school, which made me happy because it wasn't me that put them up there. And what you mentioned was one is called Think Before You Post, and it's like 10 things that you should ask yourself before you post something. And that poster was made in conjunction with Flowcabulary. So Flowcabulary is an excellent tool that creates these really catchy sort of hip-hop-based songs that teach students educational concepts. And we created a video with Flowcabulary called Think Before You Post. And if you have middle or high school students, definitely show them that video. It's really fun. Students love Flowcabulary anyway. So that video is associated with the Flowcabulary song, or that poster is associated with the Flowcabulary song. But we also have another one that is a decision tree type poster where you say, you know, I want to post a photo of my friend, now what? And kids sort of ask the questions down this decision tree, whether they end up sharing it or not. And that's really mirroring the behavior they need to do in their everyday lives. They need to ask questions before they just post, because in our culture, we're so quick to click and post and tap and share that really helping kids take a moment to pause, think about what they're doing, think about potential consequences, which could be good or bad, and before they actually decide to share something. And yeah. One thing that we always say, and it's a mantra, a lot of schools like this, is think before you self-reveal.
Right.
Think before you self-reveal.
The decision tree is really brilliant. Like number three along the tree is, could it get my friend into trouble? Yes or no. Number four, it says, is it going to cause drama? Yes or no. And you just kind of work your way through that decision tree. And it's funny because when I ran a newsroom, we had a similar decision tree when it came to using a Facebook photo and a story. And one of the paths would lead you to call an attorney. And it's just goes to show you that like these type of decisions aren't necessarily even meant for kids. It could apply to adults too. I mean, the decision tree is somewhat useful even for someone who's my age.
Definitely. And I'm glad to hear that we're on the right track, that these skills are, you know, applicable beyond students. We do hear, you know, parents need this education too. And so do teachers as well, who are sort of in a unique place that they, you know, are a member of the community and the school community, and what they post and their online lives is being closely watched and looked at. So yes, it's really mimicking the behavior that we want to go on as they make these decisions.
I don't know if you guys have this tool, but there may be tools out there like Google search engines, but are there tools that maybe teachers could teach their students, and I'm probably talking more about high school students, where they can maybe measure their digital footprint and kind of see what's out there that they maybe not realize it's out there?
Yeah, you know, I haven't come across any that are really foolproof. So, you know, a good exercise, and this is something we do in our high school lesson called College Bound, which is about digital footprint, is to just Google yourself. And there are ways that you can, if you have a common name, to try to narrow down, you know, my name is Kelly Mendoza. For me, there's also a water polo champion named Kelly Mendoza. And so how about Kelly Mendoza, San Francisco, or Kelly Mendoza, California? And the teacher modeling Googling themselves first is a good exercise, because a lot of students have never Googled themselves. And they may find something or they may not. They may find connections to their social media profiles or maybe other things they posted on YouTube. But there's not a foolproof tool to sort of measure your digital footprint. I know there's alerts that you can set up if somebody searches for you online. You can set up a Google alert or things like that. I will say that the organizations that, if you know, for adults that manage damaged digital footprints, like say that you're, you know, in a company or a high profile position and something happens and, you know, you're getting a lot of negative press. So those companies like reputation.com, mm-hmm. they can't really scrub the web free of all the stuff that's being spread about you. That's not something that can really, they can't, you know, they can try to take things down. But what those companies do is actually flood the web with positive press about the person. So they're looking to sort of push down all the negative stuff.
Right.
And so one of the things that we teach kids and really advocate, especially in middle school and high school, is that to post positive and to post things you're proud of. And then also for schools to help help students create digital portfolios of their work. Now, the digital portfolio are samples of student work, things that they've done that they're proud of. It can include their extracurricular activities. It can include volunteer activities. And eventually, if you're applying to college or a job or an internship or a scholarship, you want to have that rise to the top, where those people searching for you are finding your digital portfolio and all the great things that you've done. And I mean, a great rule of thumb is, if you don't want your grandma to see it, don't post it.
Right.
But, you know, kids are growing up online and they're going to make mistakes, and they're going through the same developmental stages that they've gone through with sort of taking risks and developing their identity. So we just have to help them through that.
Yeah, I've got to agree. Digital portfolios are great. I mean, one, your students are going to learn web skills. And two, yeah, it makes a difference when that name search, that portfolio, especially if it's been out there for a while and has a few hits, it's more likely to hit the top of the search engine. If anybody's interested in learning more about digital portfolios, I'll make a shameless plug. We did one, a specific show on that in episode 19. So you guys do a lot more than just digital footprint, you know, teaching and educating. You guys have a pretty large footprint yourself in terms of educational resources, correct?
Yes. I mean, the organization Common Sense, we do a lot of different things. In the Common Sense education, we do two main things. One is around digital citizenship and helping schools and districts implement digital citizenship alongside their technology integration. And we also rate and review educational tools for learning, apps, websites, and games. We rate them for learning potential. And we have a lot of other sort of professional development and tips and resources on teaching with tech. But I will say, if you're a parent yourself, or if you're working with parents, we do have a whole other section of what we do called Common Sense Media. And that's how a lot of people recognize Common Sense Media. They're like, oh, I've seen that. And the reason they've seen that is we rate and review media for parents to make decisions about their kids' media. And a lot of times, if you're on Comcast or Apple TV or Netflix, you will see our ratings right there when you're making a decision to help you make an informed decision.
Yeah, I think I've Googled, you know, can I take my 10-year-old to go see Guardians of the Galaxy? And next thing I know, I've got a hit on y'all's website, and it's basically telling me, you know, whether or not there's cursing, violence, and so forth. That's you guys, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, for parents, these are things that they're concerned about. It's, you know, you get to make the decision for your own kid, but it's just being informed in a way of things that parents are concerned about.
Right. Well, good stuff.
I will mention one more piece of what we do that a lot of people aren't as familiar with. So we do advocacy work and policy work on behalf of kids. And some of that is issues around media and technology, like advocating for broadband access to all kids, rural areas, you know, low-income areas, et cetera, advocating for technology in schools. But we also do advocacy work to support kids and families, starting with California in particular, around paid family leave or, you know, issues that really affect families broadly. So I just wanted to mention that that's an important piece of what we do.
That's really good. In fact, I may need to have you back on the show to talk about that, because it is important that, you know, people in rural areas do have the same access to the World Wide Web. And I'm sure you and I could probably get into a long conversation about net neutrality as well, which seems to be a hot topic.
Yes. We just experienced a big change in that. Yeah. So that we'll, you know, have an impact.
Right. It could. And we'll certainly be monitoring that. And if we start to see it impact education, I might be dialing you back to get you on the show. Again, Kelly Mendoza is the Senior Director of Learning and Engagement at Common Sense Education. Kelly, are you ready for our pop quiz?
Let's do it.
All right. First question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
I would say literacy, and that's a very broad definition of literacy, media literacy.
Okay. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Mindfulness.
What do you mean by that?
Self-regulation, mindfulness in everyday lives. It could have to do with self-regulation, meditation, health and wellness.
What does every child deserve?
Wow, that's a tough one. Every child deserves a great education.
Biggest challenge for today's educators?
Well, I'm going to scaffold this around technology. The biggest challenge for them is managing technology in their classroom.
What's the best gift to give an educator, in your opinion?
Support what they do. I feel like teachers are often, looked down upon, or anybody thinks anybody could be a teacher. That is not true. It is a difficult profession with a lot of training and smart people. So I feel like I would, I would highlight them and not have them looked down upon, which I feel like they are a lot of times.
Which teacher changed your life?
It was probably my first grade teacher, Ms. Brandenburg, just made me really love reading. And that really impacted my life.
And last question, pen or pencil?
Pencil.
All right. Again, Kelly Mendoza, we really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. And hopefully we can have you on the show in the future.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Nick.
All right. Thank you. That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and subscribe to the show. We'd also love it if you leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Tyler with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortego, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed. We'll be right back.